Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, author and theater critic Patty Hartigan discusses her recent book, August Wilson, A Life, the first authoritative biography of iconic playwright August Wilson. Hartigan is joined by actor and playwright J. Nicole Brooks. The following conversation originally took place October 30th, 2023, and was recorded live via Zoom. This episode is presented alongside our special exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice, currently on display at the American Writers Museum.
Welcome to this online program of the American Writers Museum. My name is Allison Sansoni, and I'm the program director at the AWM. We're here tonight to talk about a giant of American theater. August Wilson is long overdue for an authoritative biography, and Patty Hartigan's new book traces Wilson's ancestry back to slavery and forward into the lives of his characters and his chronicling of African-American life. She interviewed scores of friends, theater colleagues, and family members, and conducted extensive research to tell the story of a writer who left an indelible imprint on American theater and opened the door for future playwrights of color. Patty is an award-winning theater critic and arts reporter who spent many years on the staff of the Boston Globe. She divides her time between the Boston area and Charlottesville, Virginia. She's joined in conversation by Chicago-based actor, author, and director J. Nicole Brooks. Let's welcome them.
Thank you. It's so lovely to see you both.
Yeah. Thank you for getting this on.
Patty. I'm so excited to talk to you. First, I just want to lead with a bit of gratitude. You have written a stunning book, and it's so dense and rich and complex, much like our August Wilson. So I just want to say thank you, and I'm very excited to have this conversation with you.
Thank you. I'm really excited to talk to you too. The bit we've talked so far has been really inspiring.
Yes, I think so too. So let's get into it.
All right.
So I would love to know this. What was your first encounter with August Wilson? Was it by the page or was it by the stage?
It was by the stage. It was 1986. And there was a production, a pre-Broadway production of Joe Turner's Come and Gone at the Huntington Theater in Boston. And I was just out of college and I was reviewing for some tiny little weekly paper that doesn't even exist anymore. And I have to tell you, it was probably the most electric night I've had in the American theater. Those characters, the bones walking on water, the poetry, everything about it was, you're sort of at the end just stunned into a moment of silence and then roaring and standing on your feet. And then after that, I had the opportunity to go to the National Critics Institute at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in the summer of 1987. He did not have a play there that summer, but he would always come and visit. And he came and he talked to the critics, and then I sat under a tree with him at the O'Neill, and we just talked for hours. And he was such a weaver of stories. And at the time I thought, I must be the greatest interviewer in the world because he's telling me all these great stories. And then you go and you read other things. He's told the same stories with different endings and different little embellishments to everyone else. But then after that, I saw all the plays as they came out.
Well, I can't help but to remark that my entryway to August Wilson was when I was in high school, and I went to a performing arts high school, and we had a program where we would go to the Goodman Theater, which is here in Chicago, to see plays. And my first professional production was Joe Turner's Come and Gone. And when I first saw it, the second those actors took the stage, from that moment of lights up to lights to their curtain call and them talking to us afterwards, I was completely enamored and enraptured. So I couldn't help but to just go, wow, it's the same thing. Joe turns
the same on. Yeah, right. And you had the actors do a talk back too to your class. Oh. Wow, fabulous.
Oh my gosh, we were completely just like, how did you do that? And How did you tell such stories and memorize your lines and all of it? So I just, I was very curious about that. There's a quote that you use in your book from August Wilson that sort of kicks things off. And the quote is, "There is a way under, around, and through any door." I love that quote. I'm going to read it once again. "There is a way under, around, or through any door." Could you share with us a bit of how you made the decision to sit down and pen a biography? And if you could also maybe include some of the triumphs and challenges that you found in the 6 years or so that it's many years to create this.
Well, when I first started, I had just seen a production of his one-man autobiographical show called How I Learned What I Learned. And Todd Kreidler had directed it. And I think it was Eugene Lee playing August Wilson. And at the end of that production, this is Todd's genius. On the backdrop, August puts on the character, puts on his fedora, puts on his jacket, and walks off the stage. And then the names of the 10 plays are typed, because he was a real lover of typewriters, onto the scrim. I was sobbing and I thought, how could it possibly be that so many years after he passed, that there's no biography?
Mm.
So many years. I mean, it's 2023. He died in 2005. And before, what, it was 2005, actually, that he was about to turn 60 on April 27th, 2005. He was about to open the 10th play, Radio Golf, at the Yale Repertory Theater, where he hadn't been for quite a few years after he and Lloyd Richards split. And it was huge. So I had left the Boston Globe and I was freelancing and working for other places, but the Boston Globe magazine sent me to Seattle to do a huge magazine piece on him. So I had already for that piece, because a lot of people who know me know I over-research. I had every play with little notes on it and post-it notes. And so I already had a lot of the background work done. A lot of the background work, however, contained some myths and some stories that you have to flesh out, because things change over time and memories are different. And I just started to do it. Now, in terms of any project like this, you go down a rabbit hole for every little tiny fact and you search, and it's really very, very difficult to confirm the historical record from the 1860s. You go to the census, you can tell me if I'm giving you too many research trials and tribulations.
Please, this is what I'm very sure.
But, you look at a census and it all depends on who answered the door, whose kids from, a mile away were at the house, who didn't want to use their real name, who the names were spelled differently. So that was really a challenge, but it was great, because he said over and over that he didn't research. And I'll qualify that by saying he was an autodidact and he read everything. Before he sat down to write a play, he had already read everything there was to be read. But he didn't specifically say, I'm writing a play about the 1950s, so I'm going to research the 1950s. He said he wrote from the blood's memory. And there were things that I turned up in the research that were just sort of chilling in the way that where his great-grandmother lived on a mountain in Spear, North Carolina.
I was very fascinated with that inclusion of the story. Yes, please tell us as much as you can.
But so in a will where his great-great-grandfather, Calvin Twitty, was listed just by his first name, there was also a piano given to the owner, plantation owner's daughter. And he wrote a play called The Piano Lesson. There was a man called John Goss who in 1923 was accused of raping a white woman. He was worked on a chain gang, which is Joe Turner. So these things that he just knew. He never went to Spear, North Carolina. It was a situation during the Great Migration. You went north, you got out. You didn't want to go back there. His mother never went back. So he just felt all this stuff. And that was really amazing. I find I wrote most of the book. There's an old mill in West Concord, Massachusetts, and they have a wing that's subsidized studios for artists. They decided they wanted a writer and they let me in. And I was in the basement during the pandemic when there was nobody else in the building. And I'd find these little things and I'd kind of scream. And then, you know, I'd text somebody and say, oh my God, I just found this. And same at all the different libraries. One thing that was really, really helpful to me was that the director, Lloyd Richards, his archives are at the Beinecke Library at Yale. And he saved every birthday card practically. So there were things that I went there first. I discovered early on that just blew my mind. So you can tell I love research.
Well, it's all good writers do, I think. Yeah. But I think one of the challenges, how do you take, at least when you're creating, for me as a playwright, there's the taking the research and then trying to plot out what the dramaturgy is. Like, what is the story? What is the trajectory? What are we getting to? And so when you have a biography, I just am curious about how much the author can decide how much research to include, because it's all very fascinating, but how do you decide, okay, the audience needs to know everything that happened on Spear Mountain with his family and how that moves forth throughout the generations, so that by the time you're writing about how August Wilson was a voracious reader and that he basically, he talks about how he knew that he could become a writer because of what he saw on the shelf in the libraries. Yeah. That struck me so, like, the profundity of that. That's like a timeless statement. You really... You can, if you see it, you can believe it. So,
Right. I was just going to say, I'm so sad that we couldn't do this. I couldn't be in Chicago for this because the exhibit that's on the wall about the legacy of all the Black writers, I don't know if he's in it. I hope there's a little memento for August Wilson.
Let's figure out a way to get you back here and let's find out together.
In terms of process, I'm someone who believes you never start at the beginning for a biography. You know, Abraham Lincoln was born in a log cabin. That's not where you start. So I knew I wasn't starting at the beginning, but I knew I was then immediately going to jump to a more of a chronological way of telling the story. But I racked my brains about this, and I must have written my prologue 20 times because I wanted to create a portrait of the man once he had pretty much done what he promised the world he would do. And the grit and the through around under every door that he had to do also can come with a price, a personal price. And I think I read that prologue at one of my first readings and I said, oh my gosh, this is so dark. and then in terms of all the research, but editors put things on the cutting room floor that need to be taken out. Something that's so fascinating to me, because I discovered it and I researched it and I talked to 45 people, is going to just stop the reader in their tracks. That maybe there's another book on what granny women did in North Carolina, the turn of the 20th century. So a lot of that did come out, I have to say.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I did want to ask about your journey to Carolina. And would you mind sharing some of that research trip, just going to, was it North?
It's North Carolina, yeah. Spear, North Carolina, and the mountain where his great-grandmother raised her kids, and then his grandmother, Zonia Wilson, left, and she left her three children at the time. She left there with the great-grandmother, and she raised them until she passed in 1935. But the mountain is owned by the Appalachian Conservancy now, and they want to restore it to its original, you know, all native plants, all that sort of stuff. And so it's posted and there's a fence, but you can easily climb over the fence. And there was a local who had, as a child, run around in those woods and knew where the homestead was. And there was still a hearth there. which is, you know, it's amazing, right? And then there were all the courthouses and a lot of document searching where you can find birth certificates that aren't digitized. There you go to the ancient courthouse and they're on a piece of paper and you have to pay the 25 cents to use the copy machine. But it was really great. And that's where some of the local stories that I kept in the book, I found out about them. Later on, I found out about John Goss's story, which is horrifying. He was never vindicated. He was tried and the trial was maybe an hour, and the jury deliberated for 5 minutes and they gave him the chair. And so that was a really moving research trip. I also find the visits to the libraries moving too, which most people be like, yo, you are such a nerd.
I mean, I have to tell you, when I was in college, I worked in the law library, and that meant that you often had to circulate with all of the, libraries in the university. And there were many hours where I should have been reshelving and working, but I would go to the main branch. There was a collection of books that were dedicated to Blacks and African Americans and television, theater, and film. And so for me, again, this is in the 90s or whatever, so the information that we see now wasn't as readily available. And so seeing it as Mr. Wilson did, reading Paul Laurence Dunbar, or, right. I know that that was a great influence in his work. And so to hear how you were writing about or researching about from where this bloodline came, it really helps me to understand the blood memory. And it helps me understand even the character of Aunt Esther even more, just knowing that his family's history is so fascinating, and whether or not he tapped into everything, it comes out in his work.
Oh, it does. And, Aunt Esther, discovering that his great-grandmother could have been Aunt Esther, he also had such respect for the elders in his community of Pittsburgh. The woman who took them all to the Catholic Mass and made them do catechism every Sunday. Everyone was an auntie. You didn't have to be related. And any auntie on the street, if you're doing something wrong, they can tell you. But he respected that, and he felt that might, specifically in the 80s, for his 80s play, he felt that was being lost. And that's the play in which Aunt Esther dies, King Hedley.
Also remember seeing that production at the Goodman when it first and it just,
that's right. Yeah.
Yes, I saw it with Leslie Uggams, and it blew my mind. And also how I learned is actually coming back to Chicago with Congo Square Theater. Harry Lennox is attached to that. I believe he's directing. I'm not sure. He might actually be acting in it. Curious, do you have a favorite August Wilson play or piece of literature? Oh, yes. Great.
Oh, no, I do. And I've already talked about it. It's Joe Turner. And I don't think it's because it's the first one I actually saw. Because I've seen them over and over again. It's because he did precisely what he was setting out to do in that one play. And he said about it, he said if he had never written anything again, he would have been satisfied. I'm not sure that's true, but he said that. I've had teachers ask me, what play should we teach to the ninth graders? And I know in Massachusetts, Fences is on the list that they can pick for required literature for the ninth grade. But an eighth grade teacher asked me, and I said they should read Jitney. Because Jitney, there are a few things in it that my eighth graders are pretty sophisticated, but all the characters in that play are like the guy next door. Marion McClinton, the director, said, doesn't matter if you're Black, white, Martian, green, purple, these people. And it's deep, but it's also really funny, and you're not laughing at them, you're laughing with them.
What a suggestion. I love that you're giving that two eighth graders is a suggestion.
Well, I'm not. I'm telling the teachers.
I think that that should be in the curriculum because that is something that I think that we can all relate to. The fast talk and, you know, like that's very relatable. And I think that that is a great way to infuse the arts with for the youths, because sometimes we can set up theater in a way, I think, that might, we can set it up so that an audience might feel like, okay, this is something that doesn't relate to me. So I have to have a certain sort of decorum, or I have to have a certain sort of information or knowledge about the subject, but Jitney doesn't require that.
No, it doesn't
require that you know the entire cycle of, of his work.
Right. And he had written it and then rewritten it. It was so early when he wrote it. And it was done in 1982 in Pittsburgh at a little tiny theater. And everybody in Pittsburgh saw it, but nobody else saw it. But Penumbra did it. Penumbra in St. Paul. And at the University of Minnesota in their Givens Theater Archives, there was a videotape of the original one act. Marion McClinton is in it. Terry Bellamy is in it. And so I had the copy of the published play, and I got to sit and watch and then write down, oh, he cut this, he did, so I knew exactly what he changed. No, I don't know that anybody knows it's there. That was another one of those. You're there, and I think it was a really snowy day, and it was freezing, and I'm in the library for 12 hours a day. And I came across in the Penumbra boxes, I came across this videotape. Oh, I wonder what this is. And they had an old videotape machine, as they do in libraries. I put it in, and there it was.
And I have to say, when I was reading your book, it is really quite something to look at names like Marion McClinton and all of these legends and giants to see that they were like in these productions, or that they were, it was a very trippy experience to imagine them all sort of starting out or younger in their careers, I should say.
Right. Yeah. Now, the production of Joe, what year was it you saw Joe Turner at the Goodman? I'm wondering if it was the same one.
It was 1990.
Okay, that was later. So it wasn't Delroy Lindo and Ed Hall.
Wow. No, it was not.
Well, okay. That's the one that I saw.
They were great. They were fabulous. But no.
God, always. The actors are just always like top, because everybody wants to do his work.
Everyone wants to do his work. I'm curious, when you see productions that are happening, let's say now, are you, as a August Wilson aficionado, but just as a theater goer, are you a purist? Does it have to be exactly what is written? Is it open to interpretation? I'm curious what your expectation is when you go in.
I'm not a purist at all. And I'll tell you, two productions specifically that I saw, the revival of Joe Turner at the Huntington, which was directed by a woman, and the part of Bertha is so different without changing a single line. It's all in the direction. And you know, you and I know, she runs that house. Seth isn't running that boarding house. She's in charge. And there's not a single line changed. And I loved that. And also the piano lesson that was on Broadway with all the, you know.
LaTanya Richardson directed.
She directed it.
Yes, David Washington and Samuel Jackson et al. Yes.
And Daniel Brooks. It was Daniel Brooks.
Daniel Brooks, yes.
Who brought the original production that I had seen. She was laced up and not sensual or sexual. And she brought such the female spirit to that role, that she didn't have to be buttoned up, that she could let loose, that she could have desires. And that really felt different to me. And I think it's great that they're being interpreted without changing a single word in a different way. I mean, I don't want to go go off wild and do, like, you know, someone wanted to do a Western version of Joe Turner, and I thought, no, you're not going to do it. But I think they're subject, all great artists, subject to living and breathing and being a part of the world that it's in.
You write quite a bit about the women in August Wilson's life, whether they are related by blood or whether it is romantic endeavors. I'm just curious, can you maybe speak about how that influenced his work, with you also knowing him? Was he directly aware of that, or was it, what would you say?
I think I would say in the plays that take place before the 1970s, the ones that are set, he had such a deep admiration and love for his mother, even though she was a tough taskmaker. She was not all that supportive of him when he was a struggling poet who people either thought he was a lawyer or he was the town nut. And for the values of the 40s and the 50s, as he saw them, not that those values were, he idealized them. And I think that's the way he wrote his women for those plays. I think they got more complex and more rich as he developed and as he went further on in the years of the 20th century. The 1980s play King Headley, which you didn't ask me, but it's my least favorite of all the plays. It doesn't work for me at all.
You know, I should have. I would like to hear a bit more why.
He tied it to Seven Guitars, which was an earlier play. And it was all clear in his mind how everybody interrelated, but it wasn't exactly clear to the audience. And he was trying, I mean, Aunt Esther's death in that play is tragic and it's wonderful. And the character of Stool Pigeon is fabulous. But he was trying to create a Greek tragedy. He wanted to write a Greek tragedy. Mm-hmm. And so King Headley was his tragic hero who adored this man who wasn't really his biological father, but it was never clear why he was so connected with this man. But this is the thing about the women. Tanya has a speech in that play where she's pregnant and she doesn't want to bring that baby into a world where the baby might get shot, might shoot someone, might end up in jail. And that speech is, the whole play is worth it for that speech. And it's coming out of a woman's mouth, and it certainly articulates the 80s, and it articulates every Black mother's fear, but it articulates every mother's fear. And it's so eloquent. And Viola Davis, she won the Tony. Actors do it for their auditions. So even in a play that might be a little rough, there's going to be one monologue that kills you.
Yes.
And in that play, it was by a woman. And same in Fences, Rose did get to say, "You a womanless man."
I had no business doing this, but I was in college. I was cast in a production of Fences, and at 19 years old, you have no business playing Rose Maxim, but, you know, it's a university and you have to study something, and it is what it is. I just remember there were certain things that as an actor I could connect with. And sometimes, and there is a well-noted criticism of August Wilson's female characters,
right,
and how femmes are often portrayed. But I have to say, I had a similar experience in which you just listed about King Headley. And even though Fences is a completely different play and experience, I feel like there is that, there were certain things that were coming out of Rose Maxson's mouth that I knew that every woman that I knew could
at
rap.
19. Yes.
At 19.
We were precocious, right?
Oh, we'll have that conversation another day.
I know, honey.
The plays you do when you are studying acting, but it certainly was worth it because it gives you a pretty good workout. I'm curious, in creating a biography, What is it that you would say that you want your audience to walk away with that perhaps that they didn't know before?
Well, with August Wilson, one of the things, I want them to walk away with a lot of things. I certainly want them to walk away with an appreciation and a knowledge and admiration for someone who basically, you know, did everything he was told he couldn't do. But he was also a myth maker. And it was just, all playwrights are. Well, you're talking to a playwright. And they were, you know, he didn't have any trouble with myths about his life. And I found that really fascinating to uncover. I also, beginning with the play Fences, which was sort of a backstage drama, he put his foot down and said for the rest of his career, he was never going to let anyone take over his work. That he was an artist who was not, he didn't care. He didn't care if you offered him $25,000 after he just went bankrupt. You weren't going to turn Ma Rainey into a musical. And I think for any artist to do that, I mean, it's huge.
I respect that deeply about August Wilson. And one of the things, another thing that I appreciate about your book is breaking down that journey of his time in Minnesota to getting to the O'Neill, which is already a huge thing within itself, but that he was still doing it on his own terms. Like he did the O'Neill his own way. And then eventually when there was interest in commercial endeavors, he still did things in a way that it seems as though he had to do it his way or as close to it as he could.
Yeah, you mentioned the O'Neill, and he would show up with, you know, a play that was like the phone book, 4.5 hours. And everyone at the O'Neill in those days was there to serve the playwright. They weren't there to put on a good production. So the directors weren't going to hide the flaws. They were going to let the flaws. And they would tell him from the pre-conference on to the first night of performance, there's 14 monologues in the first act. And he insisted that he wasn't doing it until he saw it. And so his directors there, they were, because they had seen him at other places. He could go outside and smoke a cigarette and he'd be on the aisle so he could leave. They said, nope, you were sitting right in the center row and you were staying for the whole thing and you were going to feel the energy in the room. And then he'd go off and cut an hour in one overnight, you know? I don't know how many other playwrights get away with that.
Not very many. That very thing is sort of, I know that I've heard that many times in rooms in trying to create something as a playwright, when you get frustrated or when you feel like, oh my God, this section is overwritten, or I just need to cut. Everyone goes back to August Wilson. Even August Wilson had to cut his pages. So you have to cut. So you still hear that today. And it's a helpful thing to hear, I think, because I was mentioning this to you earlier. There's a reverence and this is perfection. Don't you dare try to change it or tear at it or question it, especially if you happen to be a Black American theater artist, that you have to accept August Wilson as gospel. There's no room for interpretation. There's no room for question. And you are not allowed to really sort of find out how it was created. You just have to accept it. Now, because when you work professionally, you start to meet people, you know, that worked with him. And so you start to get to know, like, oh, okay, that's actually when they did the production of the Goodman, they had to cut X amount of pages. Oh, okay, that lets me know. But I do appreciate that your book gets into the not so glamorous parts of how his work paged to the stage.
Right. Well, I don't think he ever wanted to be sanctified. He wanted to write his plays. So there's that, but you can't see the full picture of someone. We're all human. Every single one of us walking on this planet, we're all human and we all have our flaws and we all have our idiosyncrasies. We're not all geniuses the way he was. And I think it's really important to tell a full story. There have been biographies in recent years that I will not mention that are hagiographies. They just, you know, they put somebody up on a pedestal without saying any of the other stuff. And those are not biographies that many people want to read, I don't think. They want the full story. And the full story doesn't have to be vicious, because as I said, we're all human.
We're all human. And I think it was David Bowie who once said, all art is unstable. And I miss you, Bowie, up there.
I know.
Bouncing around space.
Oh, I love this. August Wilson and David Bowie up in space. Can you imagine? Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, we are all stardust. It's in our DNA, it's calcium in our teeth, the iron in our blood, so forth and so on. But before we assume we're going to move into some Q&A questions, I have one more question that I just have to ask you about August and Lloyd. I hope you can appreciate that for so many of us, we know this great American director from an archival point of view. Is there anything that you might be able to share with us, with you knowing these humans personally and witnessing from a different standpoint?
Yeah, Lloyd Richards was the first Black to direct on Broadway with Lorraine Hansberry, for goodness sake. And he was, I think I describe him as a Buddha a couple of times in the book. And at the O'Neill and at Yale School of Drama and at Yale Repertory Theater, he was this quiet presence who asked a lot of questions. And I didn't put this in the book, but I always felt like I was in the principal's office with him, because there was this gravitas and this experience, but so quiet. So it was kind of, you know, it was inevitable. He took, August Wilson had never studied drama. He had never studied structure. He knew how to write poetry. He knew how to create characters. But there were, you know, things like, you can't have the guy at the end of one scene soaking wet in the rain come back in, you know, a brand new suit and dry hair. But he didn't know, because so they were the perfect combination for the time for both of them. It didn't resurrect Lloyd Richards' career, but it brought him back to that Broadway world. And August needed, he called him Pop. But you get to a certain point where I said he didn't want anyone to control his work. And that was partly what it was about. He wanted to be the director. But Lloyd Richards, he's the director. So there's one sentence that, actually my editors loved this sentence. I just said, they were both right and they were both wrong.
Oof.
And that doesn't mean that we diminish either one of them. And then there were the people who took sides, and there were the people in the middle who just wanted mommy and daddy to get back together. So it happens.
Of course it does. And yeah. It's really, it's a rare picture to have such, you have two titans, these two, yeah. Not just great American storytellers, but like they've done it for the world. And so in many ways, that does not surprise me. Like it's inevitable. Like they're, you know, they're two very large entities. And
it's also an archetypal story that he wrote in his plays about fathers and sons, or older men and younger men. So there's something poetic about it, almost tragic poetry.
Yeah, and my gosh, I have to say that I would be so happy to learn even more about Lloyd Richards, because that is just such a span, decades and decades and decades of work that this person has come forth. And I'm curious to know even more.
There is someone who's working on a biography. I has been working on it for a long time, but when you're researching these things, you say that they're going to take 2 years and they take 6 to 10. So I think you can expect to see a biography of Lloyd Richards sometime soon.
Well, I have to say what you have, I hope you know that what you've done in this book is both insightful, but it is also inspirational, because for me as a playwright, there were certain sections I felt like, okay, this was written directly for me. Whereas when I did honestly, when I first started reading, my fear had nothing to do with you who authored the book, but my fear was, am I about to be told how awesome this person is, and there is no room for me to examine. So I went into it a little holding my breath, if I'm completely honest. And you know, this is all that, like, I respect August Wilson deeply, and I respect all of the people that have been interpreting his work, but it is also refreshing to look and have a book that reminds us that he was a human and that he made plenty of mistakes. And some of the mistakes were in his playwriting, thinking that he could have lights up, one thing happens, and then lights down, completely changes, which you do touch upon a bit in your book. So we're gonna, I think we're gonna pivot here, if that's okay, to welcome. So I wanna make sure that we have some audience questions. Hello.
I wanted to start with a question from Clark, who says, did August ever say who he thought was the most compelling female character in his work, especially since the male characters are the main focus of his work?
You know, it would probably be Aunt Esther, who's in four of the plays, but you only see her in one. Because she represented the Blood's memory. She was the bomb that held, he held the history, her story, history. And he did say that he adored her. And she wasn't in his mind, which is great when you finally see her in Gem of the Ocean. She's just this lady, you know, senior citizen who lives and she cooks on the stove and she yells at people and she's fabulous. She's not this, you know, 400-year-old woman. And I think he would have said that. I think he actually did. I think it might be in the book that he said she was his favorite character. What would you think, Nicole?
I feel that August Wilson wrote this cycle of plays, but really he was only writing about Aunt Esther. Mm-hmm. So I think that it is the greatest character that he has ever created.
Yeah.
And gender, not with, you know what I mean? Gender aside.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
I believe that everything comes from her. And that was, I think that that's what he set out to do. And I don't think he told us. And that's fine. I don't mind the discovery, but everything for me, everything that you've included in your biography about what happened in Carolina, moving forth to his August Wilson's parents, which is also really fascinating, his mother and father, and then, you know, the other marriages, but that,
yeah,
what a fascinating family unit they were.
Yeah,
I think that all of it boils down to Aunt Esther. Yep.
We have a question from Addie, who says, thank you for writing this book. I couldn't wait to read it. It isn't often that I buy a book, but I bought yours. Wants to know, to what extent did you get August Wilson's wife's cooperation? I know you indicated that you weren't allowed to quote from his papers.
There were discussions about the book being authorized, but it didn't work out. And so I went around through and under every door. And that's really all I want to say. I don't have any animosity about it. It just makes you dig. You have to dig a little bit deeper and work a little harder. But so many people that I've known for 30 years in the theater community were so extraordinarily helpful. And I bowed down. I dedicated the book to my mother, who was a librarian. She was a reference librarian. And you worked in a library. My daughter's currently working in a library at Oberlin. And so I also bowed down to the librarians. So,
I mean, like, they are the smartest people. They're the best people. Okay, I just have to say this about librarians. When I was in fifth or sixth grade, my school took a trip to our local library here in Chicago, which was on 48th and Michigan Avenue. And the first question I asked the librarian, I went up to her and I said, "Excuse me, I'd like to be an actress when I grow up. Can you show me how to do that?" And we went through and she taught me how to, that's how I learned research. Wow. Like, if there's something that you want, go to the library. A librarian will help you. I even tell that to any of my playwriting or anyone who's interested in writing. You should work with the dramaturg and you should work with a librarian. Those are the two key elements that you need to make any story work.
Yeah, and you know, that was also true for young August Wilson, who got his first library card at age 5 and lost it and was crying. He's never going to get another book again. And then he self-educated himself at the Carnegie Library. So we're all on the same page here. Librarians and Ann Esther.
We have a question from Cynthia, who wants to know, what was the most surprising thing you learned about August Wilson?
Oh, there were so many things. I guess it was sort of sussing out some of the myths. I can't, you know, that's a hard question. But one thing that pops into my mind was he was born Frederick August Kittle, was how his birth name. And Daisy was not married to Frederick August Kittle. She had 7 kids. She was a single mother. She raised them it was a time when they had outdoor plumbing. And this is how he comes up. And he told a story that on April 1st, 1965, he had written a college paper for his sister, who was at Fordham, which gave him $20. He walked with the $20 to buy a used typewriter, a Royal Standard typewriter, and then he had to walk all the way back up the hill because he didn't have any money left. He told that story, and he always said it was August 1st, 1965. That was the day Frederick August Kittle Sr. died. Now, is it really on the day? And then he went back and he told the story. He told it repeatedly, and it's a beautiful story. And I have a Royal Standard typewriter. It was my grandfather's. Putting the onion skin in and just typing Freddie Wilson, just different variations of his name. And then when he got to August Wilson, he said, "This is it." And he told that story, but he never told a soul that that was the day his father died. So, I mean, I found the obituary. I found, you know.
Wow.
That's
it's
amazing.
Kind of, did he change the date? Is it poetic? I mean, it's certainly poetic. It's an act of self-identification and saying, this is who I am. That kind of awed me. There was so much that surprised me.
A question from Arthur, who wants to know about the change to the end of Fences. The producer of Fences wanted the play to end with a reconciliation, and August Wilson did not. I'm summarizing, and the question is, do you know how or why Wilson eventually made that change?
Made the change? Oh, he didn't make the change in Fences. No,
so
they
the
had
play that. He says the play ends with Troy's son and daughter fondly remembering a song he sang to them.
And no, then the it ends. Agrees. And then what?
Oh, well, and then it ends. Agrees to go to the funeral.
Yeah, Gabriel, who was one of his characters, who were, you know, the poor soul who actually carried all the wisdom. He was going, and he's named Gabriel. He thinks he's the Archangel Gabriel, and he thinks he carries around a trumpet and he's going to send his brother off to heaven. He goes to blow it. I'm probably spoiling it, but most of you have seen Fences.
He goes to blow the trumpet.
Yeah, right. And not a sound comes out. And, you know, he's just distraught. And then it's a lighting trick. The sky opens up and that's them saying, "Come up, Troy, you're welcome to heaven." And August Wilson and Lloyd Richards always wanted that ending. The producers fought to get him to change that ending, and he wouldn't do it, and that created all sorts of backstage drama that led to them briefly firing Lloyd Richards. Who fires Lloyd Richards? And Lloyd Richards going back to Yale. James Earl Jones stepped in and directed for a little while, but they got what they wanted, and I'm telling you, I tell this story whenever I was just doing a talk back after a production of Fences. It is really one of the best endings in the history of American theater. That one moment when this guy opens up and Gabriel, I mean, it's just fabulous. So he won that one. I don't know where you got the impression that he didn't.
And we have one more question from Aya, who wants to know where the exhibit is in Chicago that you mentioned earlier.
It's at the American Writers Museum.
It's there where Allison is.
There we are. Yeah. So we'll put information about that into the chat.
Yes. Chicago is filled with amazing museums, but the Writers Museum is right up there. So shout out.
There we go. Well, thank you to both of you for this amazing conversation. Thank you, Patty. Thank you so much, Nick, for doing this. We really appreciate it. And everyone thank have you. A wonderful evening.
You too. It's a joy. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.